We're in Proverbs. Proverbs, the first chapter. We have now spent a little time getting our feet wet with this book. Am I on? Let's see. Nope. Am I on? Y'all hearing me? I thought you couldn't hear me. You're just ignoring me. That's the point. Okay. Proverbs chapter 1. We are going to look at the section from verse 7 down through verse 19. And as I said, we're really not going to cover this book verse by verse. We will sort of be looking at sort of sizable chunks and skipping around a lot. But to get our feet wet with this next section, let's read this text tonight. Proverbs 1, 7 through 19. Follow along as I read. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. For they shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head, and chains about thy neck. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive as the grave, or literally as Sheol in the Hebrew, and whole as those that go down into the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in thy lot among us, let us all have one purse. My son, walk not thou in the way with them, refrain thy foot from their path. For their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, and they lay wait for their own blood, yet they lurk privily for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy of gain, who taketh away the life of the owners thereof. Well, we've had a little intro into what the book of Proverbs is all about. It is about the subject of wisdom. And a proverb, if somebody would give me your best definition of a proverb, what did we say it was, or what do you say it is? A pointed saying. Okay? Yes? Great. I'm sorry? Instruction. In other words, the proverb is designed to tell you something, teach you something. Oscar? Piffy precept. Yes. Pith, for you who might not know, is the, like in a stalk, the fibrous core of the stalk. It's the meat, not the juicy part, but the fibrous part. If you want to get a little fiber in your diet, eat some weeds. You know, the pith will give you fiber. So it's the substance. It's a pithy, what'd you say, precept. Again, something that conveys wisdom to us. Anybody else want to add anything to that? That's pretty good. And that is what the book is all about. Written by Solomon. Some of it at the very end appears to be by someone else. We'll talk about that when we get there. And then we talked about the various kinds of proverbs. Do you recall there were a number of different types of proverbs? I'm not going to put them up there for you, so you're going to have to remember. What's that? Synonymous, where you're saying the same thing two different ways. Using different words, say the same thing. All right? A proverb of comparison, this is like this. Contrast, this is this and not this. We're going to have one of those in verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. It's the opposite. Okay? What else? Can you remember some of the others? It's satire. It's mockery. It's to make fun of something, and which seems rather strange that you would find that in the Bible, but there's a number of examples of it where the foolish are mocked for being so foolish. Okay? What, somebody else say something? Consequence, a proverb of consequence. If you do this, this is what's going to be the consequence. That's synonymous. That's the one Michael said. I'm thinking there's only one other. Synthesis, a synthetic proverb is where you simply build one thought upon the first thought. It's like you synthesize something, you're putting it together, you just keep adding thoughts to the original thought. And I can't, anybody else? I'm proverb evaluation. More to be desired are they than gold. In other words, this is better than this. Yes. So a number of different kinds, and we'll point those out as we go through. We may take a night just, again, exploring some of the variety of proverbs that we have. And then we looked at what I would call the preface to the book of Proverbs in verses 2 through 6. And we say a preface is where, number one, a preface comes first, and it is written by the author to sort of give you insight into the reason why he's writing the book and why you ought to read it. I mean, why go to all the trouble to read this thing? And in verses 2 through 6, we found there were seven reasons why we should read this. One of those, you'll notice, and this is very apropos for this evening, in verse 4, it is to give subtlety. It means prudence, shrewdness, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. Now notice the parallel thoughts there. By the simple, we're not talking about the mentally incompetent. We're talking about someone who is inexperienced. We might use the word naive, hasn't been around the block. Notice the parallel thought is to the young man. The young man may be a very smart young man. He just doesn't have a lot of experience. He hasn't had to face some of the things an older man is facing. And so notice that's one of the reasons why we ought to study the book of Proverbs. If you fall into the class of simple, and just looking around the room, yeah, several of you do, yeah, and or young men, here is what you ought to do. You ought to read the book of Proverbs. Here is a way to glean the wisdom of those who have been around the block a few times. Well, tonight we begin what is, I would call, a parable extolling the virtues of wisdom. Before we get into the actual wisdom itself, we have this rather long dissertation. It starts here in chapter 1, verse 7, and it doesn't end till the end of chapter 9. This is a long sort of parable, I guess you would call it. It's you'll see as we get into it what's involved. But in other words, before we really get into the Proverbs, now there's a few Proverbs that are sprinkled through this first section, but most of it is basically extolling the virtues of wisdom and impressing upon a young person to apply themselves to wisdom. And you'll see that in our text tonight. Well, let's begin. Verse 7 gives us the foundation. And verse 7 could really sort of stand alone. It could be sort of put on a plaque hung on your wall as the central thought of the whole book of Proverbs. We've talked about it already at length. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. What does that mean? That's a snappy, pithy saying. Well, what does it mean, do you think? Bonnie? Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You got to respect somebody before you're going to learn anything from them. And so this is basically saying that there's a certain mindset that you need to put on in order to learn anything from God. And the fear of God, the respect of God, it's not necessarily being scared of God, but respecting Him, acknowledging His superiority. Acknowledging that He knows and you don't. Acknowledging that you're not the sum of wisdom, a know-it-all. But you come humbly acknowledging that He knows what He's talking about. And without that fear of God, you're just spinning your wheels. So this is the fundamental thing, that before you go any further, put on the fear of God. Acknowledge His wisdom. And so I'm not going to dwell there. I want you to look, however, at the second half of verse 7. Here's the contrasting thought. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Now, there are times that the word fool in our vernacular is used to speak of someone who's mentally deficient. And that is not how the Bible uses the term fool at all. The fool may be, as we say, a very smart, savvy guy, but he's ignoring something. Ignorant is a better word, and ignorant has the idea that you're ignoring. I'm thinking of the New Testament text. They were willfully ignorant. I mean, they had it right in front of them. They chose to ignore it. And that's the idea of a fool in the biblical sense of the word. And the fool despises wisdom and instruction. He doesn't need it. He looks down his nose at it. In other words, the fool can't be taught. He knows it all. He's not in the place of a learner or a disciple. It reminds me of the thing that Jesus said, and I'm thinking of Matthew 11, about verse 28. Come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. For I'm meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest to your souls. Now think about that. To take my yoke upon you. This is what a disciple does when he goes to a teacher. He takes the teacher's yoke upon him. We use the word a mentor because mentoring seems to have a more personal relationship than a teacher, right? Because when you have a mentor, they are supervising. There's more of a personal, hands-on thing than just going and sitting in a class and listening to a lecture. You're actually having one-to-one. The mentor is questioning you and shaping you and steering you in certain directions. And that's what Jesus is saying. Take my yoke upon you. The yoke is what you use to guide the ox with. And so he's saying, if you want to come to me, take my yoke upon you and learn of me. Submit yourself to my instruction. And so that's what's going on here in verse 7. That this is the essential prerequisite to learning true wisdom. And true wisdom, as we saw back in the previous verses, produces a good person, a godly person, a righteous person. Solomon would shudder to think of a wicked man being called a wise man. Because those two concepts in his way of thinking are completely opposite. All right, well, we'll leave that. I said we weren't going to say much about verse 7. You know how I lie. Okay, let's go on. Verse 8 and 9. Notice that here in verses 8 and 9, we have a parental, guess I ought to put this up there, parental instruction to a son in this case. Now, we assume what is good for the goose is good for the gander, or what, in this case, what's good for the gander is good for the goose, that this would be applicable to daughters as well as to sons, but here it is a son who is being admonished to hear the instruction of his father and to not forsake the law of his mother. Now there's that synonymous type of proverb where you're saying the same thing in two different ways. One of them deals with the father, one of them deals with the mother, but both are admonishing the son to heed the instruction of father and mother. It is interesting that the commandment in the law to honor your father and your mother is somewhat fascinating in that it is the commandment that puts one subset of society under the authority of another subset of society. Do you catch what I'm saying? That commandment says that children ought to be ruled by their parents, not parents ruled by their children. The child is told to honor the parent. The parent is not told to honor the child. Now notice what, and I'm sort of quoting my mentor, E.W. Johnson here, when he says this is the fundamental commandment that establishes the relationships that exist within society. And that if a child is not taught to respect the authority of the parent, the child will not respect the authority of any other authority. In other words, you got a problem with a kid not obeying a teacher at school. Well, where's that coming from? A lot of times it comes from the fact that the child's not being taught to obey the parent at home. Do you understand? And you got a problem with the child getting in trouble with the law, with the policeman. A lot of that stems from the fact that he's never taught to obey authority in the home. That's such a fundamental commandment in that it sets one segment of society in subjection to another segment. Or else we might just assume that children are just supposed to be on the same level as parents. I mean, who decided that the child ought to be subservient to the parent? Well, that commandment establishes that. Do you see what I'm talking about? And so notice that here the son is admonished to heed his father and to heed his mother. Notice it says that such will be, in the next verse, like an ornament of grace. A better way of translating that, if you've got an ESV, I think it uses the word garland. A graceful garland. Now, I don't know too many of you guys walking around wearing garland. What is a garland? It's a wreath. It's a wreath shaped like a crown. That is not very prevalent in our society. It may catch on one of these days, I guess. I guess some of you guys could start it off, see if others follow your lead. But in their day, this was a ornamental thing. The wreath often was used as a symbol of victory or in the games and so forth, to wear the victor's stephanus, or the garland. But notice the second thing here perhaps is a little more apropos to our culture. It's like he says, chains about your neck. Apparently these are punk Israelites. You got a bunch of, or motorcycle gang Israelites. They've got chains around their neck. It's the idea of gold ornamentation that is around their neck. And I guess my question would be, why in the world do you wear gold chains around your neck? Now you can look at me, I don't think I've ever had a gold chain of any sort around my neck. So I'm not the person to ask, but some of the young people are very into that sort of thing. Why, what entice, and I'm looking at Chris back here, I don't think I see a gold chain around your neck, but you probably know people that do, right? What, Caleb, you can chip in here, Caleb, give us some of this wisdom you guys have been bottling up. What would possess somebody to wear a gold chain? Huh? Status. Well, a gold chain is obviously going to be something the upper crust wears, right? Set you off. It's sort of like purple for a Roman. This is a status symbol. Prosperous. You're in the money. You can afford a gold chain. But the bottom line is most people wear a gold chain because they think it looks good. It's an ornament. It dresses the, I don't know why the garland in your, on your head would do that. If you don't have any hair like me, that might cover up the bald spot maybe. But nonetheless, the reason you do that is that it adorns you. It's like a woman. I mean, I'm more familiar with women wearing necklaces and so forth. And why do you do that? Why do you put on a necklace? Anybody here wearing a necklace? Okay, yeah, got a couple back here. Why do you wear it, Tony? It accessorizes, which is the idea. What do you mean by that? Okay, I didn't realize I was opening Pandora's box here, literally. Okay, it brightens you up. In other words, it sets you off. That's the idea. It's supposed to be a way to adorn you, to bring out your natural features or whatever. And that's the idea here, is that the instruction of your father and your mother becomes that which sets you off, which makes you look good. I mean, really, it does, doesn't it? In the eyes of society, in the eyes of the world. Now, we've gone through the 60s. Some of you remember that, where all of this is challenged. But for centuries and centuries, the idea was, is that the child who submits to authority is a child that you want your child to look like. You admire the child that obeys his father and mother, that submits to their authority. This is what your goal is. This is what you're aiming at. So that becomes like an ornamentation that you want to imitate. And so that seems to be the idea here in this part. Now notice, let's go on to the next part here. There is a actual example given here that regards what we would call peer pressure. And notice it starts in verse 10 with you're telling your son, don't let a bunch of sinners entice you. This is gang mentality. It is the idea of the pressure that your peers put on you to not do what your parents are telling you to do. And it seems that Solomon uses one of the worst examples he can. I'm sure there's many, many other ways of expressing this that wouldn't be quite so antisocial or illegal as what he's going to use. You could give many illustrations, but Solomon goes to perhaps the worst illustration, that here is a gang of youths, your peers, who are enticing you to go mug somebody. He's talking about what we would call assault and battery. Go waylay this innocent guy there in verse 11. Notice, lurk for him privily. That means ambush him. We live in Memphis. We know more examples of this kind of thing than we can shake a stick at. People laying in wait to mug, to rob, to harm innocent people that are just going about their lives and minding their own business. Notice it, the innocent, do you see the last part of verse 11? Without cause? That ring a bell with you? You remember our study in Job? That's that same Hebrew word, kanam. They're robbing them and assaulting them freely, without cause, for no reason whatsoever. In other words, this is not revenge for something they've done to you. This is not get even time. This is absolutely ambushing an innocent party. And so you have this group of young people that are saying, come with us. Throw in your lot with us. Let's go ambush them. Verse 12, let's swallow them up like the grave and as those that go down to the pit. And notice the promise. We shall find all precious substances. We shall fill our houses with spoil. This is a get-rich scheme. We're going to rob them and we're going to get rich. Old Chuck French says, I think Oscar and Jim said it too in Sunday school, that sin always promises more than it can deliver. And here is the promise of sin. If you'll just come and go with us, we'll make you a rich man. We're going to spoil these. We're going to fill our houses with spoils from the good stuff we get from waylaying these innocent people. So in verse 14, cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. When you read 2 Corinthians 7 about not being unequally yoked together with unbelievers, you know, we apply that to almost exclusively to who you're going to marry. But here's a great example of exactly what that's talking about. Getting linked up with a group, having one purse, you're all going to have a common pot. It's interesting that you have entered into a communion. That's what communion means, is to share something in common. And you're going to share with this bunch of hoodlums a common pot. Okay? Let's go a little, or purse would be a better way to put it. So there is the promise. There's the temptation to the young man. The pressure of peers to conform to a mob mentality or to a gang mentality. And if you don't think that's a powerful force, why is it that we have all these gangs? The idea of the enticement to belong, to be approved of by my peers, is a powerful temptation. All right, well, then we find a parental warning about this peer pressure. Starting in verse 15, here is the parent's reply now to the son. He says, "Walk not thou in the way with them, refrain thy foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood." That's what they're up to. That's their agenda. And then this strange verse, verse 17, "Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird." As I said, every now and then you'll find a proverb sort of sprinkled through this thing. And he said it's a vain thing to spread a net in the sight of a bird. Now, what is he talking about? You're not going to do any good if the bird sees the trout, right? It's sort of like duck hunting, and they see you putting out the decoys. They know it's a fake. They know it's a trap. So in other words, a bird, and let's use the term bird brain. A bird brain doesn't fall into a trap that he sees. But here's this is how foolish they are. In verse 18, they lay wait for their own blood. They lurk privily for their own lives. Now, make the connection for me. What's he saying there? They're going to fall into their own trap. They're going to wind up getting ambushed by their own ambush. They're going to wind up paying the consequence for their own actions. Robert, you're going to say same thing? That's what he's saying. The only person that's going to wind up getting mugged is you. And we asked ourselves, I mean, is this true? Does it really work that way? Give me some examples just from life. There you go. We've been talking about sending a group up to Pontiac to work up there. And last time I was up there, one of the guys got up and, oh my, told his testimony. He was on the in Detroit and living in a crack house, and showed up at this room where they had a pile of money on the floor that they had all chipped in to go buy some crack. And when nobody was looking, he grabbed the pile of money and took off running. And they caught him, stripped all his clothes off. He's running naked down the streets of Detroit. And he said what really hit him, he realized the drug dealer was going to kill him. And he ran to a phone and called Kent up there at Gray Centers of Hope. And they sent a van down there to get him. I don't know if he got any clothes by then or not. But it's the idea that, what's the old saying? There is no honor among thieves. And if they will rob the innocent party, they will rob you. We have a terrific problem with violence in our society. But do you know who the most likely target of the violence is? It's the perpetrator of the violence. Now, that's not to say that a lot of times you have innocent parties that are harmed in the process. But those that are dealing drugs don't live long. They're in a violent occupation. They're preying on other people. And there's always a bigger fish around who will prey on you. And so that's what the proverb is saying. His son, wake up and smell the coffee. You embrace this lifestyle, and the bird has enough sense not to fly into a trap he sees. You don't have the brains of a bird. You will throw your own net and then jump in it. Now that's foolish. That's ignorant. And that's what the proverb is saying. So, verse 19, "So are the ways of everyone who is greedy of gain, who take away the life of the owners thereof." You're greedy, You want gain, you want stuff, you think you're going to get rich, and here's where that road leads. And we can say in our day and time, we see it over and over again, repeated in infinitum in our society by those trying to find an easy way. I was talking to Stephen Lees about, he was just sort of explaining how these people that steal in order to get money to buy drugs. And he says they literally work as hard at that as you would work on a job. They have a schedule they have to keep. They have to go scope the place out, have to make sure that it's going to be safe for them to go rob the place. Then they got to go rob the place. Then once you get the stuff, you got to fence the stuff. You got to go find somebody that'll buy it off of you. Then you got to get the money and go buy the drugs. And he said, you could hold an honest job and not work as hard as these thieves do. And that's the truth. He said, they've got as much of a schedule as anybody that works 9 to 5, you know. Their week is all scoped out for them. What a deception. And it's self-deception. That's what the proverb is saying. They spread the net for their own feet. All right, well, that gives you a little sample of this proverb. We'll take another few bits and pieces of it as we go. Gives you a clue of how this is working, and the admonition of a parent. It might be a father in some of it. Sometimes it's a mother talking, usually to a son, giving them advice that is practical, that is godly, that is right. All right, we'll stop there and go to prayer tonight.